Hi, this is David Sweet, founder of Focus Core, and I'd like to invite you to take a look at our 2024 salary guide. It's a great resource for hiring APAC professionals wanting to know about the salaries for executive positions within Japan, as well as finding out information of what's important to attract the best talent in Japan. The salary guide is found on our website under About Salary Guide 2024. I hope you find this information useful for you and your company. Now, on to our podcast.
Do you need to stop the recording? Like, if you end the call without stopping the recording, will everything just...
It'll do it fine. It ends by itself.
Okay, cool.
So welcome to the Focus Core podcast. Today, I'm pleased to welcome Jonathan Kant, who is a fellow colleague of mine and responsible for executive search on finance and accounting in Japan. And he recently wrote a very fascinating article, which we'll be discussing today, called Managing Local and Regional Stakeholders, for challenges for CFOs. But before we get started, welcome, Jonathan.
Hello, David. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome, and good morning to you. Let's start off with, for people who don't know you, talk about kind of your path to your current position.
It's been fairly convoluted. I started off in language learning and linguistics. I always enjoyed learning to be able to speak foreign languages, and I did French at university and found it was hard to find positions where I would be living in France or using French. So I then decided to become an English teacher. I had a friend who was here in Japan already, told me how good it was, and I came over. And then through the time that I was a teacher, I ended up moving into management and training. And I found that those were sort of areas that I really enjoyed. And so I think I developed quite a lot as a trainer and then as a people manager. And I wanted to bring those skills into an area where I might have even more opportunities to touch more varied people. I met yourself, and it was a very good opportunity to then come into this industry. So it's kind of strange that I was in language learning and language teaching, and now I'm recruiting finance professionals and talking to people in a very kind of specific subset of professional life, but I do feel like what I learned as a coach, what I learned as a trainer, and as a manager are skills that I've ended up really applying in my current position. So that's how I got where I am. And nice. Yeah.
Well, yeah, and I know you're fairly humble because you spent nearly a decade managing a fairly large team in a leading company before jumping into executive search. So I know that you brought those management skills with you. So that's important part to remember, I think. When you jumped into recruitment, what's one thing about the business that you didn't, that's kind of surprised you, you didn't expect?
I think the something that I've enjoyed is the fact that, I can be reaching out to people who are very senior and who perhaps if you make a stereotype of a CEO or someone higher up like an APAC CEO, you wouldn't necessarily, certainly where I came from, think that these kinds of people would have time to talk to me about their careers or about their companies. And it surprised me how forthcoming and willing people have been and continue to be, and to actually give me their time to speak about their organizations and their careers.
Yeah. And it's, I think it's important that to remember that, you know, you're meeting, you know, 40, 50 people a month in your field, and you're meeting these, you know, senior finance people, you know, 40, 50 of them a month. You really know what's going on in the market and who's moving and what companies are doing, oftentimes before the companies do. Mm-hmm. Which is, I think, always interesting, especially, I know you do a lot of work in APAC, and those professionals want to know what's going on in Japan, and having that large network in Japan assists you to be able to guide those people.
Yes, certainly. Yeah. It is interesting sometimes to know that something was going to happen before it actually happened. That's definitely, you could even say it's a perk of the job. Okay. In a way.
What's a common myth about your expertise?
Well, one myth, I think, just about recruiters in general, is perhaps that people sometimes maybe think that the recruiter is only after the placement. And that's definitely something which is, of course, making the placement is a very attractive part of the job. But everything that goes into that, the listening, the talking about why an opportunity would be good for somebody, for example, or why a specific candidate would be good for that client, should really reflect how much we do care about making the right the connection between the client and the candidate. And it's not just, okay, here's a CV, let's see what we can do with it, but it's more, much more to do with actually finding exactly the right opportunity that will make somebody's career move forwards, or will impact the business, in a good way.
Yeah, it's so important to highlight. I think there are some of the larger firms that are more transactional, and there's a place for that. And there's large companies, like I'm thinking about like an Amazon or an Apple, they need that kind of transactional recruitment. But what you're discussing is very much more of a consultative approach. I think and I think that a lot of recruiters are, as you say, I've been in this industry for 25 years. I find that most recruiters are sincere and wonderful people. And there's a few bad eggs, but I think in any industry, there's a few bad eggs. We just happen to be in a very public light industry as well. So what's kind of the biggest challenge that you're facing in your role right now?
So I think that we've talked about building relationships with, you know, very senior leaders, and we at Focus Core, we've had some real success, and it's, you know, it's great that we have a team because we can share ideas about how to do that. But there have definitely been some occasions where, you know, it's been difficult to reach the highest of the high, perhaps because companies are. They want to be more transactional when I want to be more consultative. Mm. It can be a shame, I think, when you've heard about an opportunity, or you've heard about a problem that a company is facing, and you think you have a solution that can really help them, and it's difficult to get the conversation going. So definitely from a point of view of building those relationships, it's not across the board easy to do. And I think it's about maybe selecting where you want to apply your efforts to kind of get the maximum, to have the maximum impact, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with that. And you recently had written a very good article that I thought was just super important to highlight, and reason one to have you on the podcast, which was, you know, managing local and regional stakeholders, because like you point out, that's a huge challenge for CFOs. And I think there's a lot here to unravel. I think let's start off with, what do you see as the difference between local and regional stakeholders?
Well, I mean, I guess what we're really talking about is whether the manager in question is in charge of just Japan, or if they're in charge of, you know, a number of countries. And I think it's natural when you've got more countries to deal with, if you're like the APAC CFO or the APAC CEO, then it's difficult to, perhaps care is a word that comes back, to invest a degree of care in precisely and exactly what people think or expect. Whereas if you're on the ground in one individual country, I think it's almost a duty of care on your part to look after not just the directives that you're receiving from on high, but also how that will impact your team or from a sales perspective, the market itself. And you want to act in a way that will, of course, as much as possible, people want to, you know, follow the directives of their seniors, but at the same time, they don't want to perhaps damage anything about the atmosphere in their team or the way people view working for that company. And potentially also if it damages the customer as well. I mean, there was a very good example when we were conducting the competency interviews for a country manager mandate recently. One of the candidates mentioned that a product that was sent over from the head office was in Europe in this case. It was a wallet. I'm obviously not going to reveal the company, but you can imagine the type of the industry. And the wallet was too small for a Ichiman yen note. So yeah, they were trying to sell a product that was, well, in its very nature, completely unsellable. And there had been very little effort gone into the localization of that particular, certainly that particular line, if not many more in that company. Mm. And I think, like, from a perspective of local management, that's where your expertise and your sensitivity has to come in, I think, as a leader. So definitely that, I mean, that was an example that sort of stood out to me in recent conversations.
Yeah, it's a challenging one. I think that's, as you mentioned, being able to very much balance between what the local needs and like you say, especially in Japan, more so than almost anywhere else in the world, you point out you don't want to upset the current team. You want to make sure that there's impact, but it's not necessarily what directly comes down from HQ. You need to kind of filter that and be a filter. And there's definitely the balancing and weighing out how much of that message flows through, which is so important. What you mentioned empathy as a key. Talk more about that.
Yeah, so I think if you don't have empathy, it's very difficult to lead effectively. By saying empathy is key, I don't think it's saying that you have to do everything in accordance with the feelings of everybody that you're working with, but you do have to try to understand where people are coming from. And you do have to have I guess when I say where people are coming from, what I'm talking about is their expectations, you know, their preconceptions. But the other thing is you have to be able to listen to understand and not judge. So, you know, even if the eventual decision may go against people's hopes, preconceptions, whatever you want to call it, you do have to have an understanding of why, basically where they're coming from and why they're thinking what they're thinking. And if you don't have the empathy, I think it's difficult to lead, actually. Because if people think that you don't care, then it's going to be very difficult for them to, you know, be part of your team. And certainly in my previous role, the final year that I spent in my previous role, we were, you know, really in the reef as far as the pandemic was concerned. And I saw it as like my responsibility to not just say, okay, the CEO said we're going to do this, so just do it. But there was an awful lot more kind of padding out, you know, how I delivered that message and also understanding what people were experiencing, because there was an awful lot going on at the time. For me, that was like a really key experience as a manager. And I think, you know, if you're in a position like a Japan CFO role or an HR director position, and you've been given, like a good example is often the big European auto companies, they run on a matrix setup, right? So it's literally Paris or Berlin said this, so let's do it. And sometimes that's going to be fine. It might not be too complicated sometimes, but on other occasions, it can be quite sort of whether this is reflective of other countries, I don't know, but in Japan, it can be quite a shock when it's a big change. And I think it's important to be sensitive to those potential shocks.
Yeah, and I think that's so important. The empathy needs to go both ways. And it behooves a CFO to take time to understand HQ and their reasonings and thought process. And sometimes headquarters doesn't want to share that information or take the time to explain. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where companies are very smart. And now that their borders are opening up again, it's easier to travel, but it's so important to really spend time in APAC or headquarters to really build those relationships.
Yeah.
And so, like you said, we're working with, you know, a lot of Japan leaders, and a mistake that I see with some Japanese nationals, if they don't take that time to empathize and learn what is their needs of headquarters and how they're thinking, and then to be able to explain that adequately locally is so important. As well as just empathizing with the local staff. I think it's easier to empathize locally here in Japan than it is just, you're always saying, someone top down said to do this, so that's why we're doing it. And I think that can be a real management suicide if you're just spouting out what someone from the top has said. And there needs to be buy-in from top management so that there's a unanimous message coming out from everyone. And I think that's just so important for Japanese leaders to really make sure that they can explain to their staff. Sure. So I think that's important. And then, which leads us to, you know, your next point was, influencing. And talking about influencing both up and down through making effective CFOs. Talk about that.
Well, I think as consultants, we often talk about how much information do you have surrounding where somebody is pointing or why they're pointing in a specific direction. Certainly over the past year and a half, I've definitely I've had to develop that skill myself. And I think it's actually a good skill for people in these kind of managerial positions to be in. To go back to the auto example, big auto companies during the pandemic, because of supply chain problems, have had to close plants for a day here, a week there, when people have basically had to either take some kind of structured leave system or possibly even take unpaid leave. And that's obviously been a company decision from on high that's been reflected in the way that local management have done what they've done. And you can't really roll something like that out. And I've experienced this again at my previous company by saying, well, it's a pandemic, so sorry, but get on with it. I think it's important to make people understand why a decision has been made and potentially how you're going to help them further down the line. Just because right now this is not a desirable result for what you're doing, perhaps we can do something later on that will kind of balance out that. And that's to do with messaging, and that's to do with having as much information as possible. So certainly what we just mentioned about the directive from global or APAC perhaps needs to be to be accompanied with more of an explanation. And even maybe some flexibility, if that's possible. It may not always be possible, but to say, well, okay, if A isn't possible, how about you try B or C? And then going back up for the CFO who's having to deliver this bad news, to then to listen to what's going on the ground and explain to his regional counterparts why, well, perhaps we can do this, but maybe we shouldn't do that. Is there any way that we can switch that decision or do something like that? So all the time, I think it's about getting as much information as you can and using the information to really make people understand more deeply and clearly about what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah, that's such an excellent point to be able to get that, because oftentimes headquarters are perceived as inflexible, whereas really, if leadership is willing to explain more and present alternatives, I think that also helps. The other thing that one of my favorite management tools in Japan is, having that nemawashi, that I think that's so important for local management to get the buy-in individually from individuals first before giving the total message. And I think that's an important aspect to influencing.
Yeah.
It's huge, that can really help a manager succeed in their career.
Well, if you're a CFO, for example, then you will have, very likely have, certainly in a larger team, you'll have an accounting team, and you'll have an FP&A team, and you may have somebody doing tax and someone doing internal controls. And again, depending on the depth of that particular finance function, you might have a lot of people that need to understand. And if you have managers below you who maybe can understand the message first, and then they can be able to explain it in the same way, I think that's very. No, I think nemawashi is a really vital part of doing this kind of influencing. Definitely.
Yeah. Would if you were talking, and as you often do, to APAC or regional CFOs, what do you tell them that they need to be aware of when they're managing, Japan business?
I think certainly there is this conception. I do wonder how different it is, but my feeling is that in Japan there's this conception that people are more sensitive to change, and that perhaps they need a bit more of a kind of a one-on-one or an arm around the shoulder to sort of to really clarify why this thing has been made. So there's definitely this kind of perceived, probably very real sensitivity in terms of how people react. Perhaps that's this this understanding that Japanese people can perhaps have a more conservative outlook, and therefore reacting to change is harder for some people. And then just the other thing is that Japanese companies, it may not be in the kind of global companies sphere, but certainly Japanese companies rotate people batch when they don't have specific skills. There's just this idea of rotation. So, okay, you were doing bookkeeping last year. This year you can do some HR thing. And then suddenly, like, someone who was doing bookkeeping 5 years ago might suddenly be in the learning and development team. And because of that, people might feel that they don't want to be pushed around, or they've had enough of being pushed around. That's one kind of thing that you know, people might be aware of.
That's good.
Yeah, and I think also that specific training may also be necessary for those kinds of people. But it's like, this perhaps is less to do with big change, but certainly on an individual or kind of team level, to understand that people might have ended up in a position almost by accident, and they could do with having some kind of really focused training to perhaps make them into the specialist that they deserve to be. You know, I've seen people who were working on the franchise department suddenly ending up in the marketing team with no real skills as a marketer, with no disrespect to them. It's just how they ended up. And perhaps if those kinds of things have happened in the past, to sort of understand that that's what has happened, and maybe we can try to make people into specialists and help them to do their jobs better.
Yeah. I was talking to a CFO recently. He started his career in marketing, and how did you end up being CFO? He's like, the bosses, he was at a panel, a discussion with three people, and they said, "You're going to be in finance now."
Okay.
What? So he finally, he's like, "Okay, well, I guess I'll move up into finance," and became a CFO. But yeah, he started his career off in marketing. So it's,
yeah, I think for those people, I think, especially if you're moving into a really specialized field, finance is a good example, I think, that the company should then say, okay, we're gonna buy you some training, whether it's like to get you up to skills on bookkeeping, or whether it's to help you do an MBA, for example, and to fund people's learning in that way and help them. I think that's definitely important.
Yeah, we meet a lot of our clients who say, well, yeah, we want someone that can hit the ground running. And it is relatively inexpensive to train someone compared to the recruitment costs to hire someone that that can hit the ground running in reality, which is always a surprise to me. Oftentimes, they could bring someone in a lower level or a different level and train them for minute cost and time compared to what it would cost to hire someone. I worked with one client. The company wanted a very specific skill set for their CFO. Across the world, they'd hired CFOs who were in their 30s.
Okay.
And you and I both know that in Japan, you just don't have the skill sets and mentality for young people yet in Japan that can be CFOs for a major retail company. They just don't have, they generally don't get trained. And they spent over a year trying to hire this person. Right. And they would have done wonders if they could have just brought, been flexible and, you know, train someone up. They ended up hiring someone in their 50s and in the long run. Before pulling out of Japan, I might add. Okay. So there's,
tell me which client that was after we've
Yeah, that was a challenge. Well, it wasn't a client. That's a, I think, just a story for the company.
Okay.
What? Let's jump back to myths about that APAC CFOs should be aware of in Japan. We always, the obvious one that we talked about is, oh, we don't do that in Japan. Japan's so different. And that to me is a myth, because I think that, you know, any country's different. I mean, 80% of the way you're doing business is the same, right? You go to Brazil, it's going to be different than New York. It's just is, right? And Japan is different, but 80% of what you're doing is the same. You have companies like IKEA or Costco, for example, who've just totally ignored it and come in and done exactly what they've done in other countries. And so you can do it in Japan. So in some ways, that's a myth that can be overused. What are some others that you would...
Well, I mean, I think modernization is something like, it's funny, it seems like Japan has gone down and then up again, perhaps if you forgive the kind of vagueness of that image, but because of films like Blade Runner, for example, people coming into Japan think Japan is like super technically advanced. And then, well, when I came to Japan, you then find out, aside from things like Hanko, there's also like fax. Was a huge thing. You talked about making a placement on the fax the other week, and so like there's this kind of crashing back down to earth experience of like, oh goodness me, wow, Japan is not technologically advanced. But then I do think that companies in the past 3 to 5 years have really been pushing to do things like paperless change, and you know, the Hanko culture seems to be changing as well. There was a politician who came in and said he wanted to get rid of, I think, Hanko and fax with his big thing a year or two ago. And it's, I mean, I think those things, maybe fax is going to go first. Hanko, I'm not sure, but certainly like this idea of a digital Hanko is something that Adobe have added to their software. So, I mean, it's essentially the same as like doing a DocuSign or something. So, from the kind of feeling that Japan is technically advanced to then learning that it's not technically advanced to now learning that it is again, or it's getting better. I mean, I met a CFO on Friday who had revolutionized the clocking in system at his company. So from having time cards, which had to then be manually inputted into Excel, which, I mean, it's extraordinary to imagine that. He implemented like a face recognition thing where, you know, any new employee, the system learned what they looked like. And then when they arrived at work, their face was scanned and that time was logged as the time they started. And I think the same goes for when you log out, when you clock out. For me, that's very technologically advanced. So it goes
but we are still in the 19th century of clocking in. We just made it electronic, so.
Well, sure. Yeah, I mean, there is that, yes. So there's a kind of like, that sort of thing is like a funny...
Someone recently told me that that they, when they bought a house, that they had to pay by cash for their down payment. They had to take a suitcase full of cash notes to the bank to do the transfer. So
with the handcuffs on the briefcase. Yeah, exactly.
So maybe we think we're technically advanced, but maybe we're still not getting there.
I think the other thing is like the old culture of going out drinking with the boss and staying out until he stays out. that, I mean, it could be partly due to the pandemic. It could be before that. I'm not really sure, but I don't feel like that is a real cultural quirk anymore.
Yeah.
You know, I often speak to candidates who say, is there a drinking culture at that company? Am I going to be expected to go out? And, you know, in large part, the answer is going to be no. You do what you want. So long as you do your job properly. I think, but there are some things which are definitely changing. And then the other thing that occurred to me on this point of myths is this idea that I think, in any country, the idea of the C-suite is that they're kind of somehow untouchable, but also that makes them feel maybe lacking in this empathy that we talked about earlier. But I've seen, and working in a Japanese company, but I've also seen it talking to people from Western companies, that oftentimes the people at the top, they do want to understand how decisions are impacting the lower echelons. And, you know, they, I've heard of CEOs, you know, setting up little kind of sit-ins with, you know, small groups of people who are maybe, I don't know, store staff or, you know, administrative staff or, you know, the as I say, the lower echelons of the company, and wanting to kind of learn to maybe change what they do. I was kind of pleased when I heard about this kind of thing happening, because there is this feeling that, you know, the executive branch, they don't really care.
Yeah.
They just want to push through their agenda and it's whatever for anybody else. But in actual fact, I don't think that's true. And speaking to both Japanese and non-Japanese executives, I see it happening more and more.
That's great. So, which is a welcome change. A lot of those are welcome changes. The changing culture and the pandemic's obviously helped with things like flex time. And there is a shortage of talent in the market, and it's even more so now than it was 5 years ago. And these changes are significant for companies if they want to survive. What are you working on these days? What are you doing nowadays in your job?
Well, so we talked about this idea of exploring and going as deep as you can. I've definitely found through the great team members that I work with how detailed people's notes can be after a meeting with a candidate or a client. And it's definitely been an area of Kaizen, if you like, from myself to sort of try and get better at asking questions. And I sort of practice on my kids in the morning or when they come back from school. What did you do today? Why did you have fun? You know, why was it enjoyable? Why don't you like this meal that I've taken forever to prepare for you? For example, yeah. So like definitely deepening my ability at asking questions, perhaps developing my curiosity is something that I've been trying to do more of.
That's a valuable quest. And, you know, those coaching questions are super important. Many of the recruiters that I've taught over the years, the one thing I always teach them to say is, tell me more about that.
Yeah.
And
what else?
And yeah, what else?
And what else is the classic, isn't it?
Yeah. It gets people talking. So besides the obvious answer to this question, I'm going to ask you is what are your favorite podcasts you'd recommend to our audience? But I think besides the Focus Core podcast.
Besides the Focus Core podcast.
Obviously. What would be a favorite podcast you'd recommend as a kind of an omiyage to give to our audience before we part?
I come from the UK. There are a lot of good podcasts coming out of the UK. Mm. There's one which, so like on a more kind of personal development type of side of things. Yep. There's one called the High Performance Podcast, which our colleague Simon introduced me to, and I listen to it a lot. They often have guests who are from a sporting background, but it's not always sporting. Sometimes it's, a business background, people who have had succeeded and really displayed high performance in their chosen area of expertise. And they talk about their career and how they got where they are and that kind of thing. And it's a really, really interesting opportunity to learn about how people became successful. Mm. So that's called the High Performance Podcast. And then just on a kind of pure, slightly missing home on occasion entertainment point of view, there's a British comedian called Adam Buxton, and he does interviews, perhaps not dissimilar from the conversation we're having right now, where he will speak to someone, whether it's a writer or a musician or another comedian, and they'll talk for an hour or so about their recent experiences. And it's not intended to be a comic conversation. It's generally just a discussion about life. So Adam Buxton, Buxton, it's just a very, very good podcaster.
That's great. We'll put links to those in the show notes.
Great.
The high performance podcast I've listened to, it used to be called Don't Tell Me the Score, right?
Not sure.
Back in the day. Yeah. And he's got all kinds of guests, but it's really interesting how he pulls in like race car drivers and then talks about leadership and it's a good podcast. I like
that.
There's
a really, really good episode with Christian Horner, who's the principal from the Red Bull Formula One team. He's been there pretty much since the start, since before they were successful, and now they have a world champion. He speaks really, really passionately and really tells a fascinating story about his success and where he's going. So that's definitely a podcast that's worth listening to.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for spending some time with me today, Jonathan. Your insights about managing local and regional stakeholders are super insightful, and always talking to you is insightful anyway. So I appreciate all that you've given today.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you for having me. It's been really nice to talk to you. Da 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 da